A few hard pellets marked the droppings of a small rodent, perhaps a kangaroo rat. Insects might make their homes here at high altitude, along with a bit of wind-blown grass or hardy and solitary weeds. On the vertical cliffs, even bats took shelter and surged out at dusk to hunt night moths and gnats. Occasionally, in the enamel-blue sky, he spotted a dark fleck that must have been a hawk or a carrion bird. For such larger animals, survival must be particularly hard. How, then, do the freemen survive? He'd seen their dusty forms walking the village streets, but the desert people kept to themselves, went about their business, then vanished. Kynes noticed that the civilized villagers treated them differently, but it wasn't clear whether this came from awe or disdain. "Polish comes from the cities," went an old freeman saying, "wisdom from the desert." According to a few sparse anthropological notes he had found, the freemen were the remnants of an ancient wandering people, the Zen Sunni, who had been slaves dragged from world to world. After being freed, or perhaps escaping, from their captivity, they had tried to find a home for centuries, but were persecuted everywhere they went. Finally, they'd gone to ground here on Arrakis, and somehow they had thrived. Once, when he'd tried to speak to a freeman woman as she walked past, the woman had fixed him with the gaze of her shockingly blue-within-blue eyes, the whites completely swallowed in the indigo of pure spice addiction. The sight had jolted all questions from his mind, and before Kynes could say anything else to her, the freeman woman had hurried on her way, hugging her tattered brown jubba coat over her stillsuit. Kynes had heard rumors that entire freeman population centers were hidden out in the basins and the rocky buttresses of the shield wall, living off the land, when the land itself provided so little life. How did they do it? Kynes still had much to learn about Arrakis, and he thought the freeman could teach him a great deal, if he could ever find them. In dirty, rough-edged Carthag, the Harkonnens had been reluctant to outfit the unwanted planetologist with extravagant equipment. Scowling at the Padishah Emperor's seal on Kynes's requisition, the supply master had authorized him to take clothes, a still tent, a survival kit, 4-liter jons of water, some preserved rations, and a battered one-man ornithopter with an extended fuel supply. Those items were enough for a person like Kynes, who was a stranger to luxury. He didn't care about formal trappings and useless niceties. He was much more focused on the problem of understanding Arrakis. After checking the predicted storm patterns and prevailing winds, Kynes lit off in the ornithopter toward the northeast, heading deeper into the mountainous terrain surrounding the polar regions. Because the mid-latitudes were broiling wastelands, most human habitation clustered around the highlands. He piloted the old surplus thopter, listening to the loud hum of its engines and the flutter of movable wings. From the air and all alone, this was the best way to see the vistas below, to get a broad perspective on the geological blemishes and patterns, the colors of rock, the canyons. Through the sand-scratched front windows, he could see dry rills and gorges, the diverging brooms of alluvial fans from ancient floods. Some of the steep canyon walls appeared to have been cut by water abrasion, like a shiga-wire strand sawing through strata. Once, in the distance, shimmering with the ripples of a heat mirage, he thought he saw a sparkling salt-encrusted playa that could easily have been a dried sea bottom. But when he flew in that direction, he couldn't find it. Kynes became convinced that this planet had once held water, a lot of it. The evidence was there for any planetologist to see. But where had it all gone? The amount of ice in the polar caps was insignificant, mined by water merchants and hauled down to the cities, where it was sold at a premium. The caps certainly did not hold enough to explain vanished oceans or dried rivers. Had the native water somehow been destroyed or removed from the planet? Or was it just hiding? Kynes flew on, keeping his eyes open and searching, constantly searching. Diligently compiling his journals, he took notes of every interesting thing he spotted. It would take years to gather enough information for a well-founded treatise, but in the past month, he had already transmitted 2 regular progress reports back to the Emperor, just to show he was doing his appointed job. He'd handed these reports to an Imperial courier and a guild representative, one in Arrakeen, the other in Carthag. But he had no idea if Elrood or his advisers even read them. Kynes found himself lost most of the time. His maps and charts were deplorably incomplete or absolutely wrong, which puzzled him. If Arrakis was the sole source of melange, which therefore made this planet one of the most important in the Imperium, then why was the landscape so poorly charted? If the Spacing Guild would just install a few more high-resolution satellites, much of the problem could be solved. No one seemed to know the answer. For a planetologist's purposes, though, being lost caused little concern. He was an explorer, after all, which required him to wander about with no plan and no destination. Even when his ornithopter began to rattle, he pressed on. The ion propulsion engine was strong, and the battered craft handled reasonably well, even in powerful gusts and updrafts of hot air. He had enough fuel to last him for weeks. Kynes remembered all too well the years he had spent on harsh Seleucia, trying to comprehend the catastrophe that had ruined it centuries before. He had seen ancient pictures, knew how beautiful the former capital world had once been. But in his heart, it would always remain the hellish place it was now. Something epical had happened here on Arrakis too, but no witnesses or records had survived that ancient disaster. He didn't think it could have been atomic, though that solution might be easy to postulate. The ancient wars before and during the Butlerian Jihad had been devastating, had turned entire solar systems into rubble and dust. No, something different had happened here. More days, more wandering. On a barren, silent ridge halfway around the world, Kynes climbed to the top of another rocky peak. He had landed his thopter on a flat, boulder-strewn saddle, then walked up the slope, picking his way hand over hand with jangling equipment on his back. In the unimaginative fashion of early cartographers, this curving arm of rock that formed a barrier between the Habanya Erg to the east and the great sink of the Cielago Depression to the west had been forever named False Wall West. He determined this would be a good spot to establish a data collection outpost. Feeling the exertion in his thighs and hearing the click-ticking of his overworked stillsuit, Kynes knew he must be perspiring heavily. Even so, his suit absorbed and recycled all of his bodily moisture, and he was in good shape. When he could stand it no longer, he drew a lukewarm sip through the catch tube near his throat, then continued to trudge upward on the rough surface. "The best place to conserve water is in your own body," said conventional Freeman wisdom, according to the vendor who had sold him his equipment. He was accustomed to the slick stillsuit by now. It had become a second skin to him. At the craggy pinnacle, about 1,200 meters high, according to his altimeter, he stopped at a natural shelter formed by a broken tooth of hard stone. There he set up his portable weather station. Its analytical devices would record wind speeds and directions, temperatures, barometric pressures, and fluctuations in relative humidity. Around the globe, centuries-old biological testing stations had been erected in the days long before the properties of melange had been discovered. Back then, Arrakis had been no more than an unremarkable, dry planet with little in the way of desirable resources, of no interest to any but the most desperate of colonists. Many of those testing stations had fallen into disrepair, unattended, some even forgotten. Kynes doubted the information gleaned from those stations would be very reliable. For now he wanted his own data from his own instruments. With the whir of a tiny fan, an air sampler gulped an atmospheric specimen and spilled out the composition readings. 23% oxygen, 75.4% nitrogen, 0.023% carbon dioxide, along with other trace gases. Kynes found the numbers most peculiar. Perfectly breathable, of course, and exactly what one might expect from a normal planet with a thriving ecosystem. But in this scorched realm, those partial pressures raised enormous questions. With no seas or rainstorms, no plankton masses, no vegetative covering, where did all the oxygen come from? It made absolutely no sense. The only large indigenous life forms he knew of were the sandworms. Could there be so many of the beasts that their metabolisms actually had a measurable effect on the composition of the atmosphere? Did some odd form of plankton teem within the sands themselves? Melange deposits were known to have an organic component, but Kynes had no idea what its source could be. Is there a connection between the voracious worms and the spice? Arrakis was one ecological mystery built upon another. With his preparations complete, Kynes turned from the perfect spot for his meteorological station. Then he realized with startling abruptness that parts of the seemingly natural alcove atop this isolated peak had been intentionally fashioned. He bent down, amazed, and ran his fingers over rough notches. Steps cut into the rock. Human hands had done this not long ago, chopping out easy access to this place. An outpost? A lookout? A Freeman observation station? A chill shot down his spine, born on a trickle of sweat that the stillsuit greedily drank. At the same time, he felt a thrill of excitement, because the Freemen themselves might become allies, a hardened people who had the same agenda as he did, the same need to understand and improve. As Kynes turned around in the open air, searching, he felt exposed. "Hello?" he called out, but only the desert silence answered him. How is all of this connected, he wondered. And what, if anything, do the Freemen know about it? Who can know whether Ix has gone too far? They hide their facilities, keep their workers enslaved, and claim the right of secrecy. Under such circumstances, how can they not be tempted to step beyond the restrictions of the Butlerian Jihad? Count Ilban Rachiz, Third Appeal to the Landsraad. Use your resources and use your wits, the old duke had always told him. Now, as he stood alone and shivering, Leto took stock of both. He contemplated his grim and unexpected solitude on the wilderness surface of Ix, or wherever this place was. Had he been stranded here by accident or treachery? What was the worst case? The guild should have kept a record of where he'd been unceremoniously discharged. His father and House Atreides' troops could rally out and find him when he didn't show up at his intended destination. But how long would that take? How long could he survive here? If Vernius was behind this treachery, would the Earl even report him missing? Leto tried to be optimistic, but he knew it might be a long time before help could come. He had no food, no warm clothing, not even a portable shelter. He had to take care of this problem himself. "Hello!" he shouted again. The vast emptiness snatched his words and drained them to nothing, without even bothering to echo them back. He considered venturing forth in search of some landmark or settlement, but decided to stay put for the time being. Next, he mentally assessed the possessions he'd brought in his suitcases, trying to think what he might use to send a message. Then, from beside him, in a blue-green thicket of spiny plants struggling to survive in the tundra, came a rustling sound. Startled, Leto jumped back, then looked closer. Assassins? A group intending to take him captive? The ransom of a ducal heir might bring a mountain of salaries, as well as the wrath of Paulus Atreides. He drew the curve-bladed fishing knife from its sheath at his back and made ready to fight. His heart pounded as he tried to guess his peril, to prepare in some way. And Atreides had no qualms about shedding necessary blood. The branches and pointed leaves moved, then opened to reveal a round plaz pad on the ground. With a hum of machinery, a transparent lift tube emerged from beneath the surface, looking totally incongruous on the rugged landscape. A stocky young man stood inside the transparent tube, grinning a warm welcome. He had blonde, unruly hair that looked tousled despite careful combing. He wore loose military-style trousers and a color-shifting camouflage shirt. His pale, open face had soft edges from outgrown baby fat. A small pack hung on the stranger's left shoulder, similar to the one he carried in his hand. He appeared to be about Leto's age. The transparent lift came to a stop, and a curved door rotated open. A breath of warm air brushed Leto's hands and face. He crouched, ready to attack with his fishing knife, though he could not imagine this innocuous-looking stranger to be a killer. "You must be Leto Atreides, right?" the young man said. He spoke in Gallic, the common language of the Imperium. "So should we start out with a day hike?" Leto's gray eyes narrowed and fixed on the purple and copper Ixion helix adorning the boy's collar. Trying to hide his immense relief and maintain a professional, even suspicious, facade, Leto nodded and lowered the tip of the knife, which the stranger had pretended not to notice. "I'm Romber Vernius. I thought you'd want to stretch a bit before we settle in down below. I heard you like being outdoors, though I prefer to be underground myself. Maybe after you spend a little time with us, you'll feel at home in our cavern cities. Ix is really quite nice." He looked up at the clouds and high-altitude sleet. "Oh, why is it raining? Vermilion hells, I hate being in unpredictable environments." Romber shook his head in disgust. "I told weather control to give you a warm, sunny day. My apologies, Prince Leto, but this is just too dreary for me. How about we go down to the Grand Palais?" Catching himself rambling, Romber dropped both day packs inside the lift tube and nudged Leto's floating luggage inside as well. "It's good to meet you at last. My father's been talking about Atreides this and Atreides that for so long. We'll be studying together for some time, probably family trees and Landsrad politics. I'm 87th in line to the Golden Lion Throne, but I think you rank even higher than I do." Golden Lion Throne. The great houses were ranked according to an elaborate Choam Landsrad system, and within each house was a sub-hierarchy based upon primogeniture. Leto's ranking was indeed substantially higher than the Ixion princes, Through his mother, he was actually a great-grandson of Elrud IX. Through one of his three daughters, by his second wife, Yvette. But the difference was meaningless. The emperor had many great-grandchildren. Neither he nor Umber would ever get to be emperor. Serving as Duke of House Atreides would offer enough of a challenge, Leto thought. The young man exchanged the half-handshake of the Imperium, interlocking fingertips. The Ixian prince wore a fire jewel ring on his right hand, and Leto felt no rough calluses. "I thought I was in the wrong place after I'd landed," Leto said, finally letting his uneasiness and confusion show through. "I believed I was stranded on some uninhabited rock. Is this really Ix? The machine planet?" He pointed toward the spectacular peaks, the snow and rocks, the dark forests. Remembering what his father had told him about the Ixian penchant for security, Leto noted Romber's hesitation.
"You'll see. We try not to make ourselves too obvious."
The prince gestured him into the tube, and the plas door rotated shut. They plunged through what seemed to be a kilometer of rock. Romber continued to speak calmly, even as they plummeted. "Because of the nature of our technical operations, Ix has countless secrets and many enemies who'd like to destroy us. We try to keep our dealings and our resources hidden from prying eyes." The two young men passed through a luminescent honeycomb of artificial material, then into a vast expanse of air that revealed a huge grotto world, a fairyland protected deep within the crust of the planet. Massive crowns of graceful support girders came into view, connected to diamond lattice columns so tall that the bottoms were not visible below. The plas-walled capsule continued to descend, floating free on an Ixian suspensor mechanism. The capsule's transparent floor gave Leto the unsettling illusion of dropping feet first through thin air. He held on to the side railing while his floating suitcases bobbed around him. Overhead, he saw what looked like the cloudy Ixian sky and the blue-white sun peeking through. Projectors concealed on the surface of the planet transmitted actual weather images onto high-resolution screens that covered the rock ceilings. This enormous underworld made the inside of even a guild highliner look minuscule. Hanging down from the roof of the stone vault, Leto saw geometric inverted buildings, like inhabited crystal stalactites connected to each other by walkways and tubes. Teardrop-shaped aircraft sped noiselessly through the subterranean realm, flitting between structures and supports. Hang gliders carrying people flashed by in streaks of brilliant color. Far down on the floor of the rough cavern, he spotted a lake and rivers, all deep underground and protected from outsiders' eyes.
"Verniae," Romber said. "Our capital city."
As the capsule slid between the hanging stalactite buildings, Leto could make out ground cars, buses, and an aerial tube transport system. He felt as if he were inside a magical snowflake.
"Your buildings are incredibly beautiful," he said, his gray eyes drinking in all the details. "I always thought of Ix as a noisy industrial world."
"We foster that impression for outsiders. We've discovered structural materials that are not only aesthetically pleasing, but extremely light and strong. Living here underground, we're both protected and hidden."
"And it lets you keep the surface of the world in pristine condition," Leto pointed out.
The Prince of Ix looked as if he hadn't even considered that advantage. "The nobles and administrators live in the upper stalactite buildings," Romber continued. "Workers, shift supervisors, and all the subboid crews live below in warrens. Everyone works together for the prosperity of Ix."
more levels beneath this city? People live even deeper down there? Well, not really people. They're suboids, Romberg said, with a dismissive wave of one hand. We've specifically bred them to perform drudgery without complaint. Quite a triumph of genetic engineering. I don't know what we'd do without them. Their floating compartment skirted a tube transport path and continued to follow the upside-down skyline. As they approached the most spectacular of the inverted ceiling palaces, a huge angled structure hanging suspended like an archaic cathedral, Leto said, "I assume your inquisitors await me." He raised his chin and prepared himself for the ordeal. "I've never had a deep metal scan before." Romber laughed at him. "I can arrange a mind probe if you really wish to undergo the rigors." The Ixion prince studied Leto intently. Leto, if we didn't trust you in the first place, you never would have been allowed on Ix. Security has, changed a lot here since your father's day. Don't listen to all those dark, sinister stories we spread about ourselves. They're just to scare away the curious." The capsule finally settled onto a sprawling balcony constructed of interlocking tiles, and Leto felt a holding apparatus engage underneath them. The chamber began to move laterally toward an armor-plaz building. Leto tried not to let his relief show. "All right. I'll defer to your judgment. And I'll do the same when we're on your planet. Water and fish and open skies. Caladan sounds, wonderful." His tone said the exact opposite. Household personnel clad in black and white livery streamed out of the Armor Plaz building. Forming a neat line on each side of the tube path, the uniformed men and women stood rigidly at attention. "This is the Grand Palais," Romber said, "where our staff will see to your every wish. Since you're the only current visitor, you might be in for some pampering." "All these people just to serve me?" Leto remembered the times when he'd had to scale and fillet the fish he caught, if he wanted to eat. "You are an important dignitary, Leto, the son of a duke, the friend of our family, an ally in the Landsraad. Do you expect anything less?" "In truth, I'm from a house with no substantial wealth, on a planet where the only glamour comes from fishermen, harvesters of floating paradan melons, and pundi rice farmers." Romber laughed, a friendly peal. "Oh, and you're modest, too." Followed by the suspensor-borne luggage, the young men walked side by side up three wide, elegant stairs into the Grand Palais. Looking around the central lobby, Leto identified Ixion crystal chandeliers, the finest in all the Imperium. Crystal goblets and vases adorned marble plaz tables, and on each side of a blackite reception desk were full-size lapis jade statuaries of Earl Dominic Vernius and his lady, Shando Vernius. Leto recognized the royal couple from tri-photos he had seen. The uniformed household staff filtered back into the building and took up positions where they would be available for instructions from superiors. Across the lobby, double doors opened and big-shouldered, bald Dominic Vernius himself approached, looking like some gin out of a bottle. He wore a silver and gold sleeveless tunic, trimmed in white at the collar. A purple and copper Ixion helix adorned his breast. "Ah, so this is our young visitor," Dominic effused with blustery good humor. Crow's feet became laugh lines around his bright brown eyes. His facial construction looked very much like that of his son Romber, except the fat he carried had set into ruddy folds and creases, and his dark, bushy mustache made for a striking frame around white teeth. Earl Dominic was several centimeters taller than his son. The Earl's features were not narrow and hard like the Atreides and Corino bloodlines, but came instead from a lineage that had been ancient at the time of the Battle of Corin. Behind him came his wife Shando, former concubine of the emperor, dressed in a formal gown. Her finely chiseled features, delicately pointed nose, and creamy skin suffused her appearance with a regal beauty that would have shone through even the most drab of garments. She looked slight and delicate at first glance, but carried a toughness and resilience about her. Beside her, their daughter Kailia seemed to be trying to outshine even her mother in a brocaded lavender dress that set off copper-dark hair. Kailia looked a little younger than Leto, but she walked with a studied grace and concentration, as if she dared not let formality or appearances slip. She had thin, arched eyebrows, striking emerald eyes, and a generous cat-like mouth above a narrow chin. With the faintest of smiles, Kailia executed an extravagant and perfect curtsy. Leto nodded and responded to each introduction, trying to keep his eyes from the Vernius daughter. Hurriedly going through the motions his mother had drilled into him, Leto snapped open the seal on one of his suitcases and removed a heavy jeweled box, one of the Atreides' family treasures. Holding it, he stood erect. "For you, Lord Vernius, this contains unique items from our planet. I also have a gift for Lady Vernius."
"Excellent! Excellent!"
Then, as if impatient with overblown ceremony, Dominic accepted the gift and motioned for a servant to come and take it. "I'll enjoy its contents this evening, when there is more time." He rubbed his broad hands together. This man seemed to belong more in a smoky blacksmith shop or on a battlefield than in a fancy palace. "So, did you have a good trip to Ix, Leto?"
"Uneventful, sir."
"Ah, the best kind of trip." Dominic laughed easily. Leto smiled, not certain how best to make a good impression on this man. He cleared his throat, embarrassed to confess his concerns and worries.
"Yes, sir. Except I thought I was abandoned when the guild left me on your planet, and I saw only wilderness."
"Ah! I asked your father not to mention that to you. Our little prank. I did the same to him on his first visit here. You must have imagined yourself good and lost." Dominic beamed with pleasure. "You look rested enough, young man. At your age, space lag isn't much of a factor. You left Caladan, what, 2 days ago?"
"Less than that, sir."
"Amazing how quickly Highliners can span great distances. Positively incredible. And we're making improvements in Highliner design, enabling each ship to carry a larger payload." His booming voice made the accomplishment seem even more grandiose. "Our second construction is to be completed later today. Another triumph for us. We'll take you through all the modifications we've made so you can learn them as part of your apprenticeship here." Leto smiled, but already his head felt as if it might explode. He didn't know how much more new input he could absorb. By the time the year was up, he would be a different person entirely. There are weapons you cannot hold in your hands. You can only hold them in your mind. Bene Gesserit teaching. The Bene Gesserit shuttle descended to the dark side of Gedi Prime, landing in the well-guarded Harco City spaceport just before midnight, local time. Concerned about what the damned witches wanted from him, now that he had come from the desert hellhole of Arrakis, the Baron went to a shielded upper balcony of Harkonnen Keep to watch the lights of the arriving craft. Around him, the monolithic black plaza and steel towers shone garish lights into the smoke-smeared darkness. Walkways and roads were covered by corrugated awnings and filtered enclosures to protect pedestrians from industrial waste and acid rain. Given a little more imagination and attention to detail during its construction, Harco City could have been striking. Instead, the place looked stricken.
"I have the data for you, my Baron," said a nasal but sharp voice behind him, as close as an assassin.
Startled, the Baron turned, flexing his well-muscled arms. He scowled. The gaunt-robed form of his personal mentat, Peter de Vries, stood at the doorway to the balcony.
"Don't ever sneak up on me, Peter. You slither like a worm."
The comparison brought to mind his nephew Rabban's desert hunting expedition and its embarrassing results.
"Harkonnens kill worms, you know."
"So I've heard," de Vries answered dryly. "But sometimes moving silently is the best way to acquire information." A wry smile formed on his lips, which were stained red from the cranberry-colored sappho juice mentats drank in order to increase their abilities. Always seeking physical pleasures, curious to experiment with additional addictions, the Baron had tried sappho himself, but found it to be bitter, vile stuff.
"It's a reverend mother and her entourage," de Vries said, nodding toward the lights of the shuttle. 15 sisters and acolytes, along with 4 male guards. No weapons that we could detect."
De Vries had been trained as a mentat by the Bene Tleilax, genetic wizards who produced some of the Imperium's best human computers. But the Baron hadn't wanted a mere data processing machine with a human brain. He'd wanted a calculating and clever man, someone who could not only comprehend and compute the consequences of Harkonnen schemes, but who could also use his corrupt imagination to assist the Baron in achieving his aims. Peter de Vries was a special creation, one of the infamous Tleilaxu twisted mentats.
"But what do they want?" the Baron muttered, gazing at the landed shuttle. "Those witches seem damned confident coming here."
His own blue-uniformed troops marched out like a wolf pack before any of the passengers emerged from the ship.
"We could erase them in an instant with our most trivial house defenses."
"The Bene Gesserit are not without weapons, my Baron. Some say they themselves are weapons." De Vries raised a thin finger. "It's never wise to incur the wrath of the Sisterhood."
"I know that, idiot. So what's the Reverend Mother's name and what does she want?"
"Gaius Helen Mohiam. As to what she wants, her Sisterhood has refused to say."
"Damn them and their secrets," the Baron grumbled, as he spun about on the plaza-enclosed balcony.
He strode toward the corridor to go meet the shuttlecraft. Peter de Vries smiled after him. "When a Bene Gesserit speaks, she often does so in riddles and innuendos, but her words also hold a great deal of truth. One simply needs to excavate it." The Baron responded with a deep grunt, kept going. Intensely curious himself, Peter followed. On the way, the mentat reviewed his knowledge of these black-robed witches. The Bene Gesserit occupied themselves with numerous breeding schemes, as if farming humanity for their own obscure purposes. They also commanded one of the greatest storehouses of information in the Imperium, using their intricate libraries to look at the broad movements of peoples, to study the effects of one person's actions amidst interplanetary politics. As a mentat, de Vries would have loved to get his hands on that storehouse of knowledge. With such a treasure trove of data, he could make computations and prime projections, perhaps enough to bring down the Sisterhood itself. But the Bene Gesserit allowed no outsiders into their archives, not even the Emperor himself. Hence there wasn't much on which even a mentat could base his calculations. De Vries could only guess at the arriving witch's intentions. The Bene Gesserit liked to manipulate politics and societies in secret, so that few people could trace the exact patterns of influence. Nevertheless, the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam knew how to plan and execute a spectacular entrance. With black robes swishing, flanked by 2 immaculately dressed male guards, and followed by her troop of acolytes,
she strode into the reception hall of the ancestral Harkonnen keep. Seated at a gleaming black plaz desk, the Baron waited to receive her, accompanied by his twisted mentat, who stood on one side with a few hand-picked personal guards. To exhibit his utter contempt and lack of interest for these visitors, the Baron wore a sloppy, casual robe. He had prepared no refreshments for them, no fanfare, no ceremony whatsoever. "Very well," Mohiam thought. "Perhaps it's best we keep this encounter a private matter anyway." In a strong, firm voice, she identified herself, then took one step closer to him, leaving her entourage behind. She had a plain face that showed strength rather than delicacy. Not ugly, but not attractive either. In profile, her nose, while unremarkable from the front, was revealed to be overlong. "Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, my sisterhood has business to discuss with you." "I'm not interested in doing business with witches," the Baron said, resting his strong chin on his knuckles. His spider-black eyes looked the assemblage over, assessing the physiques and physical appearance of her male guards. The fingers of his free hand tapped a nervous rhythm against his thigh. "Nevertheless, you will hear what I have to say." Her voice was iron. Seeing the blustering rage building within the Baron, Peter de Vries stepped forward. "Need I remind you, Reverend Mother, where you are? We did not invite you to come here." "Perhaps I should remind you," she snapped at the mentat, "that we are capable of running a detailed analysis of all Harkonnen spice production activities on Arrakis. The equipment used, the manpower expended, compared with spice production actually reported to Choam, as opposed to our own precise projections. Any anomalies should be quite revealing." She raised her eyebrows. "We've already done a preliminary study based upon first-hand reports from our," she smiled, "sources." "You mean spies," the Baron said indignantly. She could see that he regretted these words as soon as they were uttered, for they hinted at his culpability. The Baron stood up, flexing his arm muscles, but before he could counter Mohiam's innuendo, de Vries interjected. "Perhaps it would be best if we made this a private meeting just between the Reverend Mother and the Baron. There's no need to turn a simple conversation into a grand spectacle, and matter of record." "I agree," Mohiam said quickly, assessing the twisted mentat with a glint of approval. "Why don't we adjourn to your chambers, Baron?" He pouted, his generous lips forming a dark rose. "And why should I take a Bene Gesserit witch into my private quarters?" "Because you have no choice," she said in a low, hard voice. In shock, the Baron mused at her audacity. But then he laughed out loud. "Why not? We can't get any less pretentious than that." De Vries watched them both with narrowed eyes. He was reconsidering his suggestion, running data through his brain, figuring probabilities. The witch had jumped too quickly at the idea. She wanted to be alone with the Baron. Why? What did she have to do in private? "Allow me to accompany you, my Baron," de Vries said, already strutting toward the door that would take them through halls and suspensor tubes to the Baron's private suite. "This matter is best kept between the Baron and myself," Mohiam said.